G'day, it's Daniel Harford. Welcome to the Best of the Breakfast Club on RSN 927. It was jam-packed. Check it out.
Good morning, Whitey.
Good morning, Harf. Good combination, that, isn't it? Craig Lowndes and Jamie Wincup. That's as... I wouldn't say it's as good as it gets because Scott McLaughlin has won three titles in a row, but for experience around Mount Panorama and for big names in the sport, that's a serious combination.
No, there's no doubt about that. Been a combination for a long time. How many times have they raced together? One, two, three, four, five. Five times at Mount Panorama together. And they finished first on one, two, three times. So there you go. They got a good ratio of winning. Of winning at Mount Panorama, which is going to be great. When we spoke last week about the weekend that will be in Australian sport this weekend with Mount Panorama, which is always a highlight. And again, I will continue to say this, that the way that that event is covered on television is nothing short of outstanding. I love Bathurst and the way that it is covered. So really looking forward to that. We've got the Super Netball Grand Final as well, which we'll certainly be talking a bit about through the week, which I'm looking forward to. We've got the prelims of the AFL and the NRL. So fair to say, if you're a sports fan and sports lover this week, you're pretty happy about what's coming your way. Pretty happy about that. And yeah, the Brownlow for Sunday absolutely. Night.
Yes, of course. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Why is
it was
Sunday
interesting.
Night?
Oh, because they can change things up because they can. That's why. That's why.
Just checking.
They can change things up and try things differently. One thing I was... It was one of the first... Not the first. I guess there's been plenty... moments around, gee, I wish there was no coronavirus. And that was with the LA Lakers winning the NBA title yesterday. And could you imagine the additional emotion attached to that had there been crowds? And just with the Lakers winning, obviously Kobe Bryant wins a fourth title, but
LeBron
links to the Kobe Bryant... who did I say?
You dropped Kobe in for another title.
Oh, sorry.
It would have been a great achievement, let's be honest.
Yeah, it would have been an amazing achievement. Well, he could achieve many things, Kobe Bryant. More about LeBron James winning a fourth title, but under the sort of, I guess, the backdrop of what happened to Kobe Bryant at the start of the year. You know, LA Lakers haven't been a strong team for a long time, but are such a powerhouse in American basketball for so many years. But for that to all take place in front of nobody... It just was a shame, wasn't it?
Yep, absolutely. For the storyline, their first title in 10 years equals the most NBA titles with the Boston Celtics at 17. The Bryant storyline, LeBron first time in the Western Conference, it would have been big. Would have been big. Well, they're still enjoying it. The people of LA are still enjoying it out and about.
Yes, they are.
They're not too concerned about the virus, the Lakers fans out there at the moment. They're out and about celebrating and causing chaos, which I never really understood, I must admit. I don't really understand the chaos and pandemonium that ensues in the streets as a celebration where destruction happens.
It almost becomes like a tradition that it happened once and then it just has to happen because it's happened previously, that we've won, so we're going to go out and start... burning cars and throwing rocks through windows because that's what you do.
Are we burning cars and doing things like that? What happens there?
No, I don't really know.
I don't quite
a lot of
that.
What happens in America, I'm not really sure the point of at the moment. So
I wouldn't suggest we use them as a barometer for or a pointer for anything that we would like to be doing at this stage.
Wow, we do, don't we? Though that's the problem. We do. Yeah, yesterday, Daniel, that the grand final entertainment. Was announced yesterday. Very
My
exciting.
Understanding is that is true.
There's a real sort of preoccupation with that from a few people, isn't there?
Are you a fan of the grand final entertainment?
No. No, I am not. And I'm a grumpy old man, obviously, saying that. But they're now going to make it nearly half an hour, the halftime show, which I'm sure they'll call it, because... they finally get the opportunity to have it at night. So they'll turn off all the lights and they'll have fireworks and lasers and all these sorts of things. And it'll end up going for longer than a quarter of football.
Yeah, Will.
Geronimo.
Well, they'll be there. They'll be there, Steve-O.
You know what that was for a moment.
Shepherd will be there with their hit Geronimo, and Coming Home is the other one they'll be playing during the halftime break. Brisbane Indy Pop Faves Cub Sport. Now, I must admit, I'm not too au fait with the team at Cub Sport.
Not familiar with their work.
Indigenous electronic duo Electric Fields will be performing with Brisbane singer Thelma Plum, and Rockhampton Roots duo Busby Maru will also feature at the event. Of course, the DMAs. Wolf Mother's Andrew Stockdale will be performing in the Queensland Symphony Orchestra just to round out the music genres there. Led by renowned musical director Chong Lim will be performing. Chong's your man. He's all over it. Up there, Kazali, Mike Brady will also perform at the famed footy anthem from the MCG, accompanied live by the QSO at the Gabba. So we'll have an interstate version of Up There, Kazali with Mike at the G, the QSO at the Gabba. And don't forget the DMAs, if I didn't mention them, Sydney Brit Poppers. Now, I didn't know there was such a thing as a Brit Popper, but there is a thing as a Brit Popper. And I did happen to listen to a little bit of DMAs yesterday.
What is a Brit Popper?
I don't know. I think it's someone who sings and acts like they're a British pop person.
Right.
It's my only guess. I have no idea. But I did listen to a little bit of their work yesterday, just because I had never heard of them, and that's not to be disrespectful. That's just reality.
That makes me feel a lot better, because I'd never heard of them either.
No, I had to do a bit of Googling yesterday for the DMAs. A little bit of sort of Triple J sort of stuff. That's more their go. They'd be Hot 100 specialists. And the vocalist is very, very impressive. I must admit, I was a bit taken with what he's able to do. So I'm looking forward to seeing what they give. They do a great cover of Better Be Home Soon throughout this whole COVID thing. And Believe, he's got quite a unique voice, this man. So I'm looking forward to seeing how they go.
I feel like we are two old men sitting in the retirement village talking about this music, because apparently they're very popular, DMAs. DMAs, now, I'd never heard of them, and I've never heard of any of their songs. Now, I'm not really a music aficionado, apart from when we do rock out type situation where I dominate. But apart from that, I've never heard of them.
No,
I think they're for the young people.
Well, that's right. And it's an interesting model as to what they're trying to achieve, the grand final entertainment putter on us. Because you go through recent years, and we've had Tones and I was one of the recent performers, wasn't she? The G? Was that last year? Before? Last year?
I think it was last year.
Lionel Richie, which is a very different audience that you're looking for. Of course, the well-known Meatloaf, which is a different audience again. So they never really try and cater for all. It's always a section of the performance, of the crowd. So they've clearly gone for the younger market this year and did a little bit of advertising for some good Aussie local talent. Lionel Richie, of course, wasn't even supposed to be there. He was just here at the time that the replay was played, and they wanted to get someone on. And he, in my mind, was the best we've had in decades.
Yeah, how many additional people will watch the grand final because of the entertainment?
No, I don't think there'll be too many. It's about adding to the experience, isn't it? It's about adding to the product.
They're not happy enough with the football, that they need to have this.
Well, there's 27 minutes of downtime. We've got to fill that. You can't have people switching over to Grey's Anatomy or Nigella's Kitchen things. They can't be switching over. It's grand final. They've got to keep your attention. Got to keep your focus. That's all part of the show. It's all part of the show. I must admit, it's not something I necessarily look forward to with great eagerness. But when I'm there and it's on, I'm listening in the background while I'm talking to people. I haven't got the binoculars out.
Fair enough.
Looking at centre stage. Off the SMS, did you read out the grand final entertainment or the lineup for this year's Warrandyte Festival? Says Juppy from Bendigo. I don't think Juppy knows too much about them either.
No, the Warrandyte Festival didn't happen this year because of the coronavirus very early on. The Warrandyte Festival is a mid-March activity. Very big in Warrandyte. Very big in Warrandyte. You have the street parade on the Saturday, and then the famous stage in Stiggins Reserve. That's a big deal for the community of Warrandyte, Daniel.
I'm sure
don't
it is.
Don't downplay the Warrandoe Festival.
I'm just reading the messages, mate. Don't drag me into assault.
I told you that before, that one of the great stories of the Warrandoe Festival was my mum, who was running a bit late and desperate for a park. And she tried to overtake the fire engine, thinking it was going a bit slow, unbeknownst to her that that was part of the actual parade in the Warrandoe Festival. She may have made contact with the fire engine. The giveaway was that it was A, going slowly, and B, going down the middle of the road as opposed to on the left-hand side. That was why it was hard to overtake.
Yes, would have been most difficult.
She needed a park, Daniel. She was running late.
How do you run late to the Warrandyte Festival? It goes all day. Probably goes for 2 days.
My mother does not like being late to anything, so who knows.
What was she late for?
I don't know. I'm not sure. Maybe this is from Lou in Epping. Stall or something.
Straight for you, yes. This is. Right between the eyes, it is. Good morning, Daniel Adam. Good morning, Lou. Yesterday, Collingwood copped a hiding on Saturday night. Sort of makes sense. And rightly so, they have put themselves under the microscope. However, people, including you, Whitey, are trying to craft some debate suggesting that the Pies could end up going backwards next year, as GWS did for getting smacked in last year's GF. Can I remind you, Whitey, that the Pies smashed Geelong in the 2010 preliminary final, who went on to win the grand final. However, 2011, who do you think won the grand final? Yes, it was Geelong. So the rebounder is the sentiment. So Whitey, stop making it as if it's all doom and gloom for Collingwood next year and beyond. That's from Lou in Epping. Says cheers.
Well, thank you, Lou, for that well-constructed text message. Quite a long one, and that's fair enough. I'm not trying to craft anything. I'm just saying that recent history will suggest that there are two clubs that have struggled coming back from a really big finals disappointment. It happened to the Giants last year. This year, they didn't make the finals after a really good year and whatever else, and didn't cope with what happened in the grand final. And Melbourne is another example. In the preliminary final against West Coast, they got smacked, and both clubs will say that mentally they struggled to come back from that. So that is clearly going to be a test for Collingwood. I think Collingwood's absolutely good enough to be playing finals again next year, and based on a fit squad, and I don't see there being any retirements of key players, and they'll get Howe and Sidebottom back next year. Physically, they should be back making the finals again next year, but you just wonder whether that mental, the mental scarring will have an impact on things.
I do wonder the ability of clubs to dismiss this season. If you don't win,
yeah,
to dismiss it. So, okay, that was just out of the box. We've got through it. Now we can start to move forward in some normal capacity and get our minds right. I wonder what level of engagement that conversation has within the clubs that, particularly that have been around the mark or, you know, played finals, first couple of weeks of the finals, and didn't quite go all the way. You know what? It's pretty tough. It's one of those years. Look, it's a good one to win, but it's not really normal. So we can move forward pretty strong and just have that as an outlier. I wonder how much we get of that conversation.
Yeah, I think it's a really good point, Harf, and I've been speaking to a few clubs over the last week or so, and the theme coming out of it is these guys just need to get away. They need to get away from each other. That there are clubs that really did struggle in the hub, much more than we all anticipate. And the key is going to be, I think they can put a lot of the disappointment of the season down to the hub, but the challenge is actually going to be how they can actually repair the mental damage, repair some relationships, get themselves back sort of looking positively and moving forward, and not having such an unnatural year affect what their groups could do long term. Does that make sense?
Yep. No, that makes sense. Yeah, I'm sure those conversations are being had. I reckon that you will find that teams will be able to dismiss this season much more quickly than previous seasons when things haven't gone their way.
Yep,
I reckon that's right. So if we're now heading down the US path for halftime entertainment off the SMS, does that mean we can go and write and destroy things when our team wins? No, we don't want that. But it's an interesting question off the SMS. And then Feathers makes a really good point off the SMS as well. Went through the sporting landscape this weekend. You forgot the main sporting event this weekend, the Caulfield Cup, which means it must be my anniversary very soon. Oh, no, next Tuesday. It's okay. Anthony Van Dyke at 51. Come on, you good thing. Feathers from Sale. Also, isn't football the entertainment as opposed to the other stuff?
I've got a text that's just come in saying, the Killers with Jack Revolt, Meatloaf.
That was post game. That doesn't count, that one. That doesn't count. Because the Jack Revolt component doesn't count. Because that was post game. No one else saw it. It's got to be accessible to everyone.
That was on TV.
No, was it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Post game?
Yep. Yep.
They've never had the post game one on concert
no,
on
that
TV.
That was definitely on post game.
They recorded it.
Yeah. No, that was on.
Mm-hmm. I'm mistaken. It was on Seven Mate. Well, I'll be broken.
Yeah, so Meatloaf, Angry Anderson,
post-game
three of
count.
The great grand final moments. If Bruce Springsteen was playing, would I be happy that was happening? Yes.
But are they asking that question to you?
Yeah, yes. I would be happy.
Right.
But I think there is a situation, though, where a lot of the time we don't get that and the performances aren't particularly good, so it becomes a bit of a farcical event at times. The Killers was fantastic, but this is the problem, is it's hard to get international acts of relevance to be able to play.
Especially in a COVID environment.
Big ones. Yeah. But I think the post game stuff should be more of a focus, because it can be done at night, so they can turn the lights down and they can turn it into like a full on rock concert. I think that works better than doing it at halftime and potentially affecting the rhythm and the whatever of the actual game, where it all feels like a bit of a rush. People go out. I mean, again, it's the difference between being there versus being at home. That's usually when you might go and get something to eat, go to the toilet, kick the footy outside, all that sort of stuff, that a lot of people don't care about that anyway.
Yeah.
I think unless you can't get it big. Yeah, if you can't get it big, it's almost not worth having. But you can't not have it every year. So they're in a difficult position with it.
Looking forward to seeing what the DMAs have got for me. Looking forward to seeing what they've got for me.
What does DMA stand for?
No, I was hoping you wouldn't ask that. That's not a question I was looking forward to answering today. No, I don't know. I don't think it... Oh, it must stand for something. Rob Harris has joined us on the line, AP's global sports correspondent, about the big story in English football, which we need to get across, because there's a lot of complexities to it, I reckon. And Rob is on the line. Good morning, Rob.
Good morning. I was just weighing up promotion and relegation within Van Halen and promotion and relegation within sport as well. Dumped out of a league, dumped out of a band, replaced.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, it seems to happen a bit these days, Rob, with music as well as in football. And the promotion relegation conversation is heating up in the world of English football, because my understanding is, well, following your tweets from yesterday, in fact, a Project Big Picture has got a lot of people talking about the future of the structure of English football. Can you explain a little bit more about what's happened and why this has come about?
Yeah, well, at the heart of it, the fact that in England we have the 92 professional clubs, the 20 in the Premier League, the 72 in the English Football League, and between the Premier League and the EFL, there's already this huge financial gulf, given the fact, obviously, the EPL is the world's richest league. And what we've seen exacerbated in recent months, with no fans allowed into stadiums, is a complete collapse in revenue, particularly affecting the EFL clubs who don't have those big TV deals and the money coming in from the Premier League. So the EFL have had a responsibility to try to find a way of keeping their clubs alive. And the chairman of the competitions, Rick Parry, has been in cahoots with the Premier League to try to find a restructuring. But he's not been in talks with the entire Premier League or even the Premier League leadership, but just with Liverpool and Manchester United, to form a plan which would see more of the Premier League's cash flow down into those lower leagues to help them out. But at the heart of it, this apparent act of benevolence Liverpool and Manchester United are using it as a way of, if this package goes through, of getting themselves more power in the Premier League. Because as things stand in the Premier League, if you want to change anything, it needs 14 of the 20 clubs to agree. Under this plan they're trying to push through, it would only need 6 of the longer-serving 9 members, and at the same time, the Premier League would drop to 18 teams. So it's all about cash and power.
OK, so Manchester United and Liverpool are in this up to their ears at the moment, and they've got Rick Parry, the chair of the EFL, on side. Who's opposing it? And obviously a power play by anyone, and particularly two big power clubs like those two, would be raising alarms throughout the whole structure, I would think. But who are the main vocalists opposing it? Not Sammy Hagar sort of vocalists, the other ones.
Well, ultimately, it's the Premier League who are actually speaking out against it. They've attacked Rick Parry by name, and they've also said it would damage English football as a whole. And, you know, they think that there would actually be increased disparities between the top and the bottom Premier League teams. It's quite fairly equitable in terms of how things are shared out now. I mean, if you finish around bottom, you'll get about £100 million in prize money. Once you're relegated, you get some further assistance. And probably the top team gets around £150-odd million, something around then. So, you know, they think the distribution model will actually become less fair under this new system. And the government as well. Downing Street has criticised it. Imagine a government criticising backroom deals. But that's what they've done, as if politicians are never involved in anything behind closed doors. But, you know, it's reached the levels of government. You could. It also does intertwine with, you know, issues at the heart of government at the moment. They're deeply involved with discussions about how the clubs survive who haven't got a revenue, and also the Premier League is in discord with the government over the fact fans aren't being allowed back into stadiums while they're being allowed into some other venues. Although in the last hour or so we've had Boris Johnson speaking from Downing Street again about the deep concerns about the rise of coronavirus cases, which also just a reminder how hard it's going to be to get fans back into stadiums. But yeah, there's a lot of criticism around, and crucially it is Rick Parry is the EFL chairman who's the public face of all this, pushing for it, advocating it, and defending the role of Liverpool and United's American owners. And those two clubs so far have been silent publicly as they've been had their plans sort of torn apart by elements. But, you know, within the EFL, you know, they potentially see pound signs.
So, Rob, how much of this has got to do with the fact we're living in a coronavirus world and it's a way of changing things up, particularly from a financial perspective, and how much of it is just this is what they want to do because they've always wanted to do it? Because we have had these sort of, or this sort of speculation before around creating a Europe sort of Super League with 6 or 8 of the best British teams with teams from mainland Europe, all that sort of thing. How can you sort of work out exactly what they're looking for here?
Well, as you mentioned, the Super League, a lot of this could actually feed into enabling the elite to play more games in Europe, because suddenly you'll only have 18, not 20 teams in the league, so your number of games a season is reduced, so that frees up space in the calendar to go internationally. At the same time, it potentially creates a new Premier League international competition. The EFL Cup, the second tier cup below the FA Cup, potentially disappears. The Community Shield between the FA Cup winners and the Premier League winners goes. So that's another fixture that isn't really appealing, that you potentially are able to go out and play fixtures against some of the more illustrious European names. And a part of it, you know, potentially Premier League teams might be giving up to fund this package, which would see £250 million immediately given to help the lower leagues. Then in future, once 8.5% of the Premier League's revenue is spent on costs and other things, they're offering a quarter of their annual revenue then to from the Premier League to the EFL clubs. But even just very basic calculations based on current deals, that might cost a Premier League club around 20, 30 million at most a year. And if you're Manchester United to Liverpool, you can go out and potentially make a lot more of that internationally, particularly with various other aspects of this vast document as well. So this isn't just the Premier League seeing its duty perhaps to help the lower league clubs survive. And these are lower league clubs, even in the fourth tier. can get thousands of games when they're allowed in. They're using it to try to get more power, and that's why it's gone down so badly. But it all comes, obviously, you know, are they trying to make the most of a crisis to get something out of it for themselves? Because as it stands now, it's very hard to see, you know, when fans are going to be back into stadiums, given the rise in coronavirus cases again.
I've played in six prelims, and four of them have been decided by under a kick. So they've been pretty hard to win.
Tough to win. That's what Grant Birtle tells us from the Brisbane Lions these days, of course. Six prelims he's played in, four decided by under a kick. It is the greatest weekend of the year, as far as I'm concerned, if you're a footy fan. And Rocket Ead knows all about them. Been involved in lots of them as a player and a coach, and he joins us on Coach's Corner. Good morning, Rocket.
Morning, Half. Morning, Whitey. Good to talk, mate.
Great going? To have you with us. Grant Birchall straight up says they're the toughest games to win. Your experience back that up?
Yeah, they seem to be. They seem to be the best games, don't they, of the final series. And I think this weekend, now they're the four best teams. These teams have proved themselves to be the best four. And you know, we're looking forward to some great games. I think they should both be close. So hopefully they sort of mirror the first week of the finals. It'll be great to see.
We were talking yesterday, Rocket, about falling into the elimination final winners and falling away from the qualifying final losers. Yeah. Both of the losers were emphatic, which does highlight your point that the top four teams have been and are the top four teams by quite some margin.
Yeah, and I think you're right. I think it's about nearly 80% now of teams that lose the first week and the qualifying final win the next week. And probably a disappointment for me was Collingwood. I thought that might have been the better game of the two. You know, St Kilda gave a bit of a whimper, actually. They challenged. They just couldn't kick straight. They probably would have been a little bit closer. But, yeah, I think you know, certainly the Cats and the Tigers were emphatically the best two teams on the weekend. And I think they'll go in with a fair bit of confidence going into the preliminary finals.
I was listening to Jonathan Brown on the couch last night on Fox Footy talking about the travel from WA to Brisbane, or WA to Gold Coast. Mm. You've done that as a Gold Coast coach. And the following week, it was the discussion about what happens to that team the following week. Now, you, when you were coaching the Gold Coast Suns, didn't exactly have a premiership caliber team there, so it's slightly different in terms of your expectation, I'm sure. But did you notice a lull in performance after you travelled from the West the week prior with the Suns?
That certainly can take it out. I mean, it's the longest trip in Australia. It's a bit over 5 hours. But I think it's probably the accumulation of their travel and accommodation. Like, obviously, going the week early, but going into isolation or quarantine for a week. And then the travel back, a six-day break. So, or seven, yeah, six-day break. Yeah, so... Mm. I think it was going to be tough for them. I know they've had the compressed season where it's 4s and 5 days, and Collingwood had the worst fixture of that with Geelong. I mean, Geelong coped with pretty well, but Collingwood had the 4-day break and a 5-day break in that period of, I think, 3 games in 12 days. So I think then that travel certainly would take it out of you. I think they went in with a bit of confidence. I think what people have missed out of all this is that Geelong lost the previous week. They would have been stung. They got criticised a little bit.
Yep.
And they went to work and did their homework. They moved the ball a lot quicker. They were a kick mark team. Collingwood would have been prepared for a kick mark side. And all of a sudden, they've got this team that's put speed on the ball, played on, handballed to the player running pass. And all of a sudden, they're going over the Collingwood players and got through them. And I think we're probably digging a bit too deep on the fatigue factor and that sort of thing. I think it was more the preparation of the Cats side, who actually did something different. And I think Whitey and I have spoken, or we've spoken about that a fair bit, about teams preparing do their homework and actually giving the opposition something they don't expect. And Collingwood are a team that go on history and on evidence and say, well, this is the way Geelong are going to play, but they didn't play that way. And I think it caught them. Actually caught them damp, with their pants down, and now they got off to a flyer, and then and the Pies never got back into it.
It is one of the things I must admit I admire about the Cats, and we've talked about this through the year, Whitey, that I think they have the most effective modes of play and more modes of play than other teams in the competition, and that's one of the reasons why they've been so successful this year, top four team now into a prelim. I think Chris Scott's done a great job with building a team that's flexible. And in modern footy, I reckon that's one of the great strengths because it's so unique, Rocket. No one is flexible. Everyone plays the same brand of footy every week, and very rarely do you get a side change the way they play.
I totally agree, and I think we've spoken about it a bit that a lot of the modern day coaches is this is the way we play, and just so if you're smart enough to prepare your team to take away the asset of the opposition, but also yourself to give them different looks of what about the way you play, as you said, yeah. Mode of transport. So do you go quick? Is it kick mark? Is it boundary? Is it corridor? Is it long? Is it short? Blokes in different positions, a whole range of different things you can do because opposition generally, and players are literal learners, literal thinkers, so they'll do what the coach... So it makes it easier for coaches. Okay, if we've got one mode of transport, the players know that and we'll get into a groove, but the you're not accounting for the opposition, and I think Geelong did that very well, and certainly the Pies didn't expect it.
We've spent a lot of time over the last couple of days talking about the ramifications or the implications on Collingwood. It's sort of mixed. Some of our audience think that Collingwood will be okay. Other members of the audience are a bit worried about the potential impact of such a heavy loss. What sort of corner do you sit in with Collingwood?
I don't know if the impact of the loss if there'll be a big impact on the loss from the loss. I think teams bounce back from one week to the next. They get a belting, they bounce back. So I know they've got the whole summer to mull over it. I'm more worried Collingwood, really their age demographic, that I know Howard didn't play, but he's coming to 30. Pendles is over 30. Sidebottom would be 30. Ruffett, if he plays, is 30. Greenwood, if he plays, is over 30. So they're getting an older squad, and they haven't rejuvenated enough. I know they've got some kids coming through, but I wonder whether that famed window, whether that's been their chance the last 3 years, and it's sort of just going past midnight at the moment. And so that's more... It would be interesting to see over the trade period how they rejuvenate, whether they lose to Goey or whether Treloar goes, which I've got a view on that. So it would be interesting to see what the makeup of their squad's like. It would be more the issue, I think.
Don't bury the lead, Rocket. What's your take on Treloar?
Right. Oh, no. My view is, and everyone's... And I heard last night on 360, they're saying, oh, well, Adam's such a... And I don't know Adam Treloar, but he's such a family man. He'll go. But partner's only signed a 10-month contract. What happens? She goes, and then in 10 months, she goes and plays somewhere else or she finishes. Like, I can't see Adam Treloar going. I know he's denied it and all that, but... professional sport is on such a fine edge, and she's signed a 10-month contract. That finishes in 10 months. I think they'll bite the bullet and see what happens over the next 10 months, and he'll start Collingwood. I can't see you take that risk about it.
So, Kim Revellian, you're talking about Adam Treloar's partner who plays or played with the Magpies in the Super Netball competition. Of course, she started at the Firebirds in 2013, so she's going back to play for the Firebirds through that contract. She's only 27, so it's an interesting contract full stop. A 27-year-old Australian diamond, like she's a serious player, Kimmy, and only signed a one-year deal or 10-month deal with the Firebirds, Whitey, which has got the footy world in a frenzy.
Yeah, it has, and the key to that is that she didn't play this year because she had a baby.
Yes.
So I think that's why potentially it's a short-term contract to sort of keep her own options open more than anything else, because she's not only national standard, she's international standard. So if she wanted to play for the Firebirds for the next 3 or 4 years, I think that they would like that very much. Yeah. So it's not like she's 32 and you know, maybe playing one more season. So that does make it complicated. There's no question about that. Now, Adam Treloar, through his network, have come out in the last 24 hours and said that he wants to stay. But as we know, it's like Carlton saying they're not interested in Jordan Dugowie. And we'll talk to Glenn McFarlane about this a little bit later on. They're not interested in Jordan Dugowie if the price tag is of significance. But if they can get him at the right price, that's a different conversation. So, yeah, it's going to be really interesting. I think the thing with Collingwood, I reckon you're 100% right, Rocket. It's more about the age of their star players. and a lot of their star players are over 30. And, you know, Pendlebury and Sidebottom are the two that just stand out. And this is the problem that Collingwood's got. And I'm not trying to death ride Collingwood or anything like that, because they've got an opportunity to fix their problems through the trade period. But the problem, what is going to come back to haunt them, is that trade for Dane Beams. Because they were the picks that they, you know, in hindsight, should have kept so they could replenish with good young players. And they can't just rely on the father-sons coming through. They went all in with Dane Beams, and it hasn't worked. And their history says there's always going to be consequences to that, to your list, when you go all in on someone and it doesn't work.
Oh, for sure. There's no doubt about that. Now, there was a lot of negatives about that. His money obviously precludes them as well, getting someone else in. They're trying to keep their stars. And also the draft picks that they've had to give up, bites them on the backside at the moment. And they need to actually rejuvenate and regenerate. They've fallen short this year for a whole range of reasons, injuries and a whole range of things, but they need to... they need to get some new blood in. I think Nathan's done a really good job of, you know, Quaynor and some Browns and a few others have come in and got some kids. But they'll need some more. Now, you would think Grundy will play better next year, not being in a hub. Hopefully there's no more hubs, but there's obviously a chance there could be. So it'll be interesting to see how they go and how they react to it and what they do internally as well. I think their external message is pretty good from Eddie and Nathan and the club itself, but they can't go in with the same squad. If they don't make too many changes, I wouldn't have thought they'd be challenging for top four.
So what is the key thing they need to do? There's been talk that they need to get a forward. There's talk they need to get another key defender. There isn't so much discussion around their midfield. If you're list manager at Collingwood, what's the main focus for them through the next period?
Well, I think a forward is obvious, is the obvious one, and they've struggled to kick goals. The interesting thing will be about De Goey. I'd love to be on a fly on the wall. Are they prepared for De Goey to go, get compensation, go for Cameron? And they've got their... So that fits both ways. They might get something for De Goey and they don't have to give up anything for Cameron. So all of a sudden they've fixed it in one foul swoop. I think Roughhead struggled a bit in the finals, you know, if you get into that age and get on the tram tracks a bit, so that probably tall defender. Now, Moore's excellent player, but do they need another one? My check for me is the interesting one where they haven't got a lot of money in their cap, and if I was Melbourne or a few other suitors, I'd be certainly dangling the carrot in front of him. Look, because you know what you're going to get from him. He's not going to kick 80 goals or 60 goals, but he's going to be there all the time. So... I think you say their midfield's good, but as I said, Pendles is 30-odd. If Treloar goes, probably doesn't. But Sidebottom's 30. Do they need someone else in there as well? Do they need... Adams not a great kick. Treloar probably not a great kick going inside 50. And we talk about kicking goals and their entries inside 50 are not excellent. Do they need a polish? So they've got either end of the ground, but in 12 months' time... maybe a midfield as well might be an issue.
He's no superstar. He's no Dusty Martin. He's no Patrick Dangerfield. He hasn't deserved the $1 million price tag that's been thrown around, and anybody wants to pay him $1 million, I say good luck. Because, you know, this is a different era. At this stage, I reckon he's a $700,000 player at the most.
The great Tony Shaw talking about Jordan De Goey and where he fits in the grand scheme of things. Of course, a Magpie champion. And he'll be watching with great interest as to what's happening at his old club at the moment. And Glenn McFarlane also is a Magpie champion in our eyes from the Herald Sun. One of the all-time greats, one of our favourites here on the Breakfast Club. It's been a while, Magga. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning, Half and Whitey. It has been a while. I think the champion Magpie was in my dreams more than anything else.
No, you're much better than that. You're much better than that, Macca, and we will continue to outline that to the masses and let them know of your awesomeness. Perhaps not at the highest level, Macca, but it doesn't matter. You're a Leviathan racehorse owner as well, which we'll talk about one day too. But we've got a bit to talk about with your Magpies, because Jordan De Goey is front and centre, and then all of a sudden, Adam Treloar snuck into the news as well.
Yeah, this is one that's sort of come from left field. If you remember back 12 months ago, the Pies actually did consider potentially a trade for Treloar to the Gold Coast for that number one pick. Imagine Matt Rowell in a Collingwood jumper would look pretty well, wouldn't it? So the fact is, this time again, it's come around for different reasons this time as well, with his fiancée Kim Revellian obviously taking on that short-term 10-month contract with the Queensland Firebirds next year. I spoke to Adam a couple of weeks ago before the West Coast game, and he mentioned that Kim was making a comeback, didn't say where it was going to be. He is so connected to their daughter, Georgie, that it is fascinating that he's going to have to spend a fair bit of time apart. The Suns are keen, absolutely no doubt, but both Adam and Collingwood and his manager, Tim Hazel, who actually manages Kim as well, have poured cold water on the fact that there's any chance that he could go to the Suns for, say, a pick five at the end of this year. But I suppose you never say never, guys, in this situation. At this particular time, with all sort of trades at the moment, there's a lot of jockeying for position. But the Treloar camp have been very strong that this won't happen, that this is only a 10-month contract, as Rocket said a moment ago, as opposed to Adam's got a contract with Collingwood till the end of 2025, guys. That's a long way away, isn't it?
Right. That is a long way away. I wasn't aware of his status. There was some conjecture last night, Macca, about whether or not Collingwood had been taken along in this journey with Kim's future in netball, or whether or not they had. One report saying that they had no idea what was happening with Kim, one saying that, yeah, they're fully across it. Is there a reality there or the truth there?
I think it's come about pretty quickly, in a sense. When I spoke to him a couple of weeks ago, he said that she was considering a comeback. They hadn't quite finalised it, but surely enough, that was probably been a month or two in the planning in a lot of ways. But I think the Pies were a little bit surprised, but Adam has been really strong on the fact it is going to be difficult for him because he's spent pretty much every day with his daughter Georgie, who was born the week after round one. So he's basically been with her the whole time, the daughter, and with Kim as a part of that hub. But Adam's very keen. He did say at the time that he was very keen for Kim to chase her dreams. But it's going to be difficult. Kim's mum's obviously going to spend some time up in Queensland. I agree with Rocket. I'm sure he'll stay. But it is just a fascinating one. And this time of year, how amazing is it? There's always a left field one that comes out of the blue, isn't there?
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. And there'll be more. There'll be more. There's no doubt about that.
Well, yeah,
no one knows who those names will be. Well, it will be because it happens. I mean, the trade period's still weeks away. And already we're seeing, some jokers coming out of the pack, which is clearly the case with Adam Treloar. The Jordan Dugowie scenario, Glenn, seems to be moving really quickly in all sorts of different directions. What's your read on it as it stands at the moment?
You're right, Whitey. It is moving quickly, and it is intriguing. I find this one very intriguing. I think deep down, Jordan Dugowie wants to stay, but he wants to be compensated for somewhere between $900,000 to $1 million. Now, that's way over the odds for his current output. As Rocket was saying, it puts him in a, and Tony Shaw was saying, it puts him in a Dustin Martin, Patrick Dangerfield bracket. In fact, if he got $1 million, it'd be a fraction more than what Patrick Dangerfield is getting. He's around that sort of figure. Carlton have distanced themselves from Jordan Dugowie at the moment, saying they haven't offered him a deal, but there's no doubt that there's been some interest there. And earlier in this year, there was communication between the camps. Same with Essendon. Essendon have said, privately, this is not going to happen. But, I feel a lot of this is jockeying for position. The issue that they're balking at and will continue to balk at is both a monetary and a trade compensation. It'd be very hard for either of those clubs to justify spending $1 million on someone like Jordan Dugowie, given their own internal issues. Carlton have got some money, no doubt. But also the trade implications as well. There'd have to be a trade, and then they'd have to try and sort out a way to compensate Collingwood for that. Collingwood will want a lot. So at this stage, I think deep down he wants to stay. He's just got to work out what sort of price range that he's willing to accept to stay at Collingwood.
Got better yesterday at the current state of the Bombers, and a lot of talk about players leaving. But what about this one staying and building around, I think, the future of the Essendon Football Club after 78 games in 4 years? Andrew McGrath signed a 2-year deal to stay at the Bombers, and they are very happy about that. I'm sure he is as well. He joins us on the Breakfast Club. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning, guys. How are you going?
Yeah, we're going very well. How are you coping post-hub? Are you in Melbourne or where are you at the moment?
I just got back to Melbourne. I
was up in Queensland for a couple of weeks post-season, and then got back on Sunday. So I'm back in Melbourne and loving being home.
Oh, I was going to ask you, loving being home. I mean, you're stuck in the house effectively. You got a 5K radius you're allowed to get involved in, and you're loving it. That's good news.
Yeah, I think we're away for a long period of time. It's nice to sleep in your own bed and be familiar with the surroundings. And I guess although Melbourne is going through a difficult time, we missed a lot of it, which we're very grateful for.
Can I ask you about the new deal, 2-year deal to stay at the Bombers, which I'm sure every Essendon supporter woke up to and saw the news yesterday and thought this day is going to be fantastic because Andrew McGrath is going to stay at my footy club for another 2 years. I must admit, when I saw the deal length, Andrew, I thought, bloody hell, they've undersold him here. I would have tried to lock you away for 5 or 6. Was there ever any conversation about a bit of a longer-term deal?
Nah, not really. I think I'm still very young, so I'm only 22, and I don't think too many 22-year-olds sign much longer deals than that. So I was pretty content with the 2 years, and then we go from there. But I'm stoked to stay at Essendon. It was always my intention throughout the season to stay, and it was just a matter of getting a few things right. But I can't wait to see where this group can go. And obviously, right now, things are a little bit difficult and we're navigating our way through an interesting time. But I've got full belief in the footy club and Truck and the direction we're heading. So it made my decision very easy.
Andrew, take us through that. I mean, while you've been up in Queensland, there's been a hell of a lot of talk about Essendon, but you're inside the bubble. You're inside the football club. You said before, challenging, interesting period. Take us through, what's it like?
It's always different. I guess probably the first time in my career where there's been a lot of, things going on in the media, things being said about us. No doubt our performance this season wasn't where we wanted it to be. We lost a lot of games and our football wasn't consistent enough. And as a playing group, we take that personally and want to be better. But in terms of sort of the off-field stuff now, it's something you just navigate through. It's a part of our job. People are going to leave. People are going to come in. And although we're losing, or probably losing some great people, I'm sure we'll bring in some great people because of that. And I'm excited about the opportunity that that'll bring for our playing group. And inevitably, it just gives our group more opportunity to thrive and become better and be fully committed.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, but are you concerned about the players that are leaving, or are you actually excited that you've actually got clarity on the direction of individuals that makes it easier to make directions about the team?
No, I'm definitely not concerned. I think, like I said before, it's disappointing to lose great people at your footy club. The guys that we're speaking about are great people and mates of mine, so it's sad to see them go, but I think from that comes great opportunity. And as you said before, we get great clarity on our playing group, and we have people in the footy club that are 100% committed to achieving with us, and I'm excited by that. I think we'll be able to bring in, whether through the draft or trade, people that are 100% committed that will join our playing group and hopefully make an impact and send us in the right direction.
I think it's great that we're able to talk to you today, particularly when you're meant to be on holidays. And it's great news that you've signed from an Essendon perspective. But I'd love you just to sort of share a message to the Essendon fans, but also to potential players that might want to go to the football club about the direction. What is the direction, the confidence you've got in Ben now? It's his own team. I guess this is an opportunity to reach out and talk to the fans and tell them what's going on.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think our fans have been so, I guess, dedicated and committed to us, and I just want them to know that we're working every day and striving to be better. And although this year was disappointing and there's things going on right now that are out of our control, stick by us. I think Truck's putting together a great game plan and is getting all the right people in the right places to play a more defensive style of football that stands up in finals and is also exciting with our player as well. So I think in the near future, we're going to see that. Despite this year, we didn't see it as consistently enough. I think our young core of players are really determined to achieve and improve and consistently get better and get us in that top bracket of teams where we inevitably want to be. So again, it's an exciting time for us. It's challenging. I think it's challenging for every team trying to improve, but we're all really determined to get there.
Andrew McGrath has joined us from the Bombers, signed a 2-year extension or a deal to stay at the Bombers for the next couple of years, which is great news. Just on the whole dynamic, John Walsford leaving, of course, this year as the senior coach or the manager, I suppose he probably was this year. How different will it look day-to-day for you and for the team next year in terms of the way just the club operates and training looks next year as opposed to this year?
I don't feel there'll be a huge difference. I think this year was great. As John really empowered Ben to take a lot of control over things and really, I guess, gave him the reins in a way whilst overseeing it all. And so I don't think there'll be a huge change in that facet of our footy club. I think it'll be great for Ben to have full control over the footy club and I guess really shape it the way he wants to, and we're fully confident in his ability to do that. So I don't think there'll be too many changes.
Yeah, well, I must admit, that's what I thought I'd get from an answer from you, and that's what a lot of people have thought through the year, that despite the fact there's been some conversation about who's coaching and leading the strategy and tactics and game plan stuff, that it probably won't change too much. It'll just give you a chance to spend some more time perfecting and mastering it. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, definitely. I think you hit the nail on the head. Ben's still a very young senior coach, and he's learning and growing every day with all our players. So it's an exciting time for our footy club, and he's got great relationships with all the players. And I'm really excited to see where we can go under his lead and guidance.
And that's it. It's over. This historic 2020 NBA championship belongs to the Los Angeles Lakers.
They are the kings of the bubble, the Lakers. Let's touch base. Let's go stateside and get the reaction from LA and find out how it's all going with the celebrations in tow at the moment. Mike Trudell is a sideline reporter for the Lakers and co-host of Thompson and Trudell for all the latest sporting news in LA. He's good enough to join us on the Breakfast Club. Welcome, Mike.
Guys, it's my pleasure. I know how many Laker fans and NBA fans there are in Australia, so it's always a pleasure to join you folks down under. What's happening today?
It's all happening. We're looking, basking in the afterglow of a magnificent performance by your boys, the Lakers, in the bubble at Disneyland. A remarkable series, a remarkable season in many ways, isn't it? And we were talking this morning, Mike, about how big it would have been at the Staples Center with the storylines throughout the year of the Kobe tragedy early doors, LeBron's first Western Conference final championship. Like, there's so many storylines that it would have been massive had we had crowds at the Staples Center to watch it all unfold. Do we miss a trick there by not having it?
There's no question about it, right? That's kind of been the story of 2020, right? It's been a difficult year, and I think that the inverse, though, right, the other way, is that they wouldn't have won the title, and that would have sucked worse. So this was the best possible solution for how this season could have possibly ended. And I remember back, so my first year working with the Lakers was in 2008-2009, and of course that year they win the championship in Orlando against the Magic. And I remember at the time, so winning on the road, because then of course the Lakers win the title at home next year against Boston, but winning on the road was really special, because it's just the team there. And so, there's a big party in the hotel ballroom. All the players are there. There's a couple family members, some of the executives, but really it's kind of a small traveling party. And that, that's like, for me, that will be a lifelong memory. And Kobe's daughters were there, by the way. Kobe's wife was like, and just being able to look over and seeing him holding his little girls. Like, those are the kind of memories I think that these guys now will have. So for the team itself, it's still super special, and it still pays off what they had accomplished. Of course, for the fan base at large, that's where you feel bad. You don't get that chance to really revel in it as a group. But hopefully, right, guys, depending on how the United States continues to do with COVID, and of course that has not been great, hopefully that continues to improve. Hopefully at some point next year a vaccine comes along and you're able to get some of those big crowds and buildings again. And at that point, then you can get that kind of full celebration. It's not the same as at the time, but at least you'll hopefully get that at some point.
It's finally happened. The Lakers are the champions again. It's taken a while, and obviously it helps when you've got LeBron. But can you, for someone that like you that have been covering the team for such a long time, are you surprised at how quickly it's happened? Is it what you expected? Take us through all of that.
Yeah, so this is where you have to really kind of gauge expectation, based on what the fan base is. And I wish I had the Australian football or like the rugby equivalent to what a team is that is so dominant that not winning every year is like a true hurt for the fan base. Because there are a lot of teams in the NBA where if it had been 10 years between titles, hell, that would be incredible, right? But that's not how it is for the Lakers because they have had such success over the course of the history, and that's just what life is about, right? It's about what you expected at the beginning of the season. I do think, though, that if you are a Lakers fan, if you're somebody that follows the team, there's always that sort of confidence that another star is coming at some point. It typically doesn't take that long. You know, I'd say the longest stretch that you've seen is anywhere between 7 to 10 years. You know, the gap between Magic and Kareem and Shaq and Kobe, the gap between Kobe and Pau Gasol and then LeBron, right? It's always in that 7 to 10 year mix. And right now, Anthony Davis remains in his absolute prime at 27. And LeBron, for somebody that's 35, I mean, could he have looked better in the finals? Right, he was just spectacular. He does not look like he's slowing down anytime soon either. And so that is, I think, the expectation that the Lakers have. But it's for a reason, right? It's because that's what's been right in front of them. And so to me, I am not surprised. I did figure even when they were struggling in those in-between years, I knew it was always a matter of getting rid of some of the bad contracts. There were two of them. And of using those young players either to attract a free agent or to use in a trade. And it turns out they did both, right? They attracted LeBron in free agency, and then they made a trade for Anthony Davis. Then you fill in the veterans around him, and boom, you're in contention again.
This weekend, a great sporting weekend, is going to be topped off with the magnificent event at the Mountain, Bathurst, the Super Cheap Auto, Bathurst 1000, live on Fox Sports 506 from Thursday. And Craig Lowndes will be looking for title number 8, if you don't mind. If there's one man who knows the Mountain inside of that, it is the legend of Australian motorsport who joins us on the Breakfast Club. Good morning, Craig.
Good morning, guys. Yeah, sort of looking for what's building up to be a great weekend.
It's going to be a very different weekend, as the whole season has been, of course, through the whole COVID environment. And I was looking through your record this morning, Craig. 26 years ago was your first Bathurst in 1994 with Brad Jones. You finished second. How has the race changed? And we know that technology has changed and the cars have changed a bit, but how has the race changed since 1994?
Well, I think because of the cars and everything else, they're more reliable, they're faster. And I also think that the co-drivers, I remember when you say back in 1994, when I first went there, I was struggling. I was trying to work out how to position the car, how to flow the car, and I was probably about 2.5 seconds off Brad Jones' time. So I was really out of my depth, and it wasn't until, I suppose, you know, Peter Brock sat me down and actually talked to me a lap of Bathurst that I started to feel comfortable and confident, and then you started to close that gap in lap time. So I think today's race, it's faster. As I said, the cars are more reliable, stronger, but the co-drivers, there's not a lot of time difference, lap time difference between a co-driver now and a main driver. So it really is intense for the 1,000 kilometres or 161 laps.
And I know you're en route to Bathurst at the moment. You'll get there about 2 o'clock this afternoon, so I'm being told. So you're nearly there. You're getting ready to hit the mountain and get ready for a big week. Do you get adrenaline kicking in about this time as you get to the mountain? Of course, it's the season end of this year, which I think is a fabulous part of the calendar to have this as the season ending event. But do you get adrenaline leading into Bathurst?
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt about it. I think as you get closer to Bathurst as a township, that will intense. And I think that intensify, it really is one of those things that normally we drive down the East Coast, go over the Blue Mountains. And when you see that white rock of Mount Panorama on the hill, it gives me goosebumps. I think it's one of those special moments. We classify it as, well, I do, as an AFL or an NRL grand final. It really is one of those moments where we know it's the biggest race of the year. As you mentioned, it's going to be the final race of this season, which hasn't happened since 2000. So it's been a long time since we've concluded the championship at a place like Bathurst. Although we know that Scotty McLaughlin's won the championship itself, we're all now heading to Mount Panorama to win the big one. And for me, it's always been that. I've always said if I had a choice between a championship and a Bathurst, I'd always lean towards the Bathurst.
Right, okay. So you've driven it so many times. Do you just sort of lie in bed at night thinking about how you can go quicker or how you could potentially attack the mountain differently to get quicker times? Or you've done that many times, you've exhausted all those possibilities?
Well, you never can be too complacent around a place like Bathurst. It'll bite you very quickly. And I think that there's no doubt that I suppose, like any athlete, you visualise what you want to do and then how you want to obviously position the car. So all the key points and the elements of brake markers, turning points, you know, where to position a car across the top of the mountain, that really hasn't changed or fundamentally changed over the years. But it's as you said, the car's involvement of getting faster, more downforce, braking harder and deeper down into the chase at 300 kilometres an hour. I think it's all those little small, elements that you really try and put together to get a perfect lap around there. And I've got to say, over the 26 years, I probably count maybe a dozen times, well, not even that, half a dozen times that I've actually had a perfect lap. Like, it's just an amazing bit of road, the 6.24 kilometre, you know, the elevation change, everything. Like, you're a pioneer every lap.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm interested in, and I think we talked to you at the same time last year about your preparation, because it's so different to a lot of the other drivers who have been driving through the year, how much practice you can get to make sure that you're as sharp as you can be for Sunday. What have you done this time around?
Well, yeah, with all the this year, it's been very difficult, I suppose, with all the changes and the COVID and the calendar changes all the time. We haven't had a lead-in, like our normal lead-in test day that we would be at Queensland Raceway and, you know, doing driver practice changes, which we've had to do that at the workshop. You know, just getting familiarised with the ergonomics, the layout of the car, which we fundamentally haven't changed too much since the last time I drove last year. But my last competitive drive was at the Melbourne Grand Prix in March. So for me, you know, it's really important to use the experience, get up to speed, make sure that we minimise any mistakes that we have, hand the car back to Jamie in a good position like we did last year and let him run at home. So for me, it's sort of a very simple layout, but when I say simple, we've still got to execute it. We've still got to make sure that we, you know, as I said, make minimal mistakes.
That was the best of the Breakfast Club. If you want to hear the full interviews again, go straight to the website, rsn.net.au.